And for his sanity and mental strength, he needs to have a reason he can point to for his loss. If he didn't make excuses, if he didn't have a reason to think he can win the next time, how could he ever fight again? And this is a guy who's dedicated 5, 10 years of his life to this. When fighters don't make excuses, they're pandering to the crowd. Because in their heart, and in private discussions with their trainers, they have reasons they lost and reasons they can win the next time. The public line may be, "It just wasn't my night." But there are reasons to hope your night will come. I have my own experience with loss. I lost my first, and only, MMA fight. I have tons of excuses, believe me. And the worst part was that it was stopped from cuts. It leaves you with questions in your mind. Being a thin-skinned white boy, I bleed easily. I once heard a trainer discussing an opponent say he bleeds during the national anthem. That could be me. The loss wasn't so bad, but the days and weeks after, and getting stuck with a bloody post-fight picture as the cover of your book, try living with that. Yeah, I have excuses. The defining moment for a fighter isn't victory, but the way he deals with defeat. George Foreman suffered one of the most momentous defeats in fighting history when, as the heavy favorite, he lost to Muhammad Ali in Zaire. It was a crushing, mind-numbing loss. If you haven't seen the documentary When We Were Kings, you should. After Zaire, Foreman wouldn't fight for a year. He fought a couple times, and then he had another tough loss and a terrific attack of heatstroke and exhaustion in the late rounds. He felt he nearly died. George had seen his own mortality, and had had enough. He retired from boxing and became a preacher. Then, 10 years later, in 1988, Foreman started his comeback, fighting in small shows as an old man at the age of 38. He was grotesquely overweight, a blimp at 270 pounds, and boxing writers looked the other way in embarrassment. George was humiliating himself. But George kept fighting, 5, 8 times a year, against mostly unknown guys, gradually losing the weight. When he'd won the title as a young man, Foreman was a physical specimen and a devastating puncher, but he would almost always gas in the late rounds. Now, as a washed-up old man, he was doing better. He said it was because he was fighting without the nervous tension that had exhausted him. George took it all the way to the heavyweight championship and Michael Moore, who just won the title. Teddy Atlas was training Moore at the time, and he wrote about the fight in his book Atlas. Moore was the heavy favorite to win, but Teddy remembers feeling pangs of misgivings. He even threw up. Foreman wasn't running from his ghosts. A guy who was able to face the truth that way was a dangerous guy. That was why I had thrown up on the day of the press conference. I had recognized that about Foreman, Teddy later wrote. When Foreman came jogging down to the ring, Teddy saw he was wearing the same shorts he'd worn in Zaire as a young lion. And now, he was a battle-scarred old bull. To wear those same shorts, the ones that had been worn when he suffered the biggest defeat in boxing history, meant that George couldn't be stopped. His mind was too strong now. This was his night. Moore, the smaller, faster man, took it to George for 9 rounds. But he was making small mistakes, standing in front of Foreman for a little too long. Teddy recounted afterward the ploy. "I'm an old man. Don't worry about this. Don't worry about this slow jab." Moore maintains that George got lucky. There is no doubt that George was working on something all night, laying a trap, or more like manufacturing a slim opportunity. Moore maybe got a little cocky. He was putting on a boxing clinic at George's expense, and then he got caught with a 1-2 in the 10th, a left jab followed by a right straight. It got through, and you can see on George's face just the gleam of understanding, and he instantly dropped another 1-2 through Moore's guard. Not big, huge punches, but Foreman was a big, huge man, and a born puncher. And then the second right hand was on the button, and Moore was knocked out. Teddy Atlas would later say, "I got angry afterward at people who said Michael quit. They didn't understand." Neither did the people who said Foreman got lucky. He didn't get lucky. He spent 20 years preparing to throw that punch, learning what he needed to get to that precise moment in time. Foreman won the heavyweight title at the record-breaking age of 45, the oldest ever to win it. He knocked out the 26-year-old Maurer. He turned the tables on Zaire. He had made himself the hero of the story, the bigger hero of history. With Rory bleeding from some tiny cuts and an eye swelling shut, we headed back into the locker room. Rory was swinging from acceptance into despair and back again, a sort of common, obvious thing. He wanted to talk about what went wrong, what he needed. Pat said, very frankly, "Wrestling, dude." And it was true. Rory needed to be able to defend those takedowns with his life. When he had his man hurt, he had a window of opportunity that he needed to keep exploiting. Brett's takedowns had bought time to recover. In the dressing room, Zaymario Sperry, a jiu-jitsu expert and a co-founder of Brazilian Top Team, asked Rory incredulously, "What happened, man? That triangle looked very tight." He was commiserating but curious, professional. Rory shrugged. He wasn't sure why he hadn't finished Brett with the triangle, but he blamed that long struggle in part for his loss. When he finally gave up squeezing, he'd burned his legs out. He'd squeezed and felt totally gassed afterward. I think that the manner in which he'd dried out, the 1.5-hour workout from the day before, probably made him susceptible to this. But it is a danger. Go for a submission too early in a fight, when your opponent is still strong and he defends well, and you burn yourself out, muscularly, squeezing. Submissions have a much higher success rate later in the fight, when your opponent's already tired. They're rarely perfect in a real fight, but imperfect submission can still work. Now it's about squeezing everything, making his life horrible and depressing until he taps just as a way out, just to get it to stop. If he's already a little exhausted, then he might be more prone to look for a way out. The downside is that when a guy is slippery with sweat, he has a better chance of pulling out of submissions. When he's fresh as a daisy and full of beans, he won't quit or believe he has to. I later looked up Brett Cooper's history and saw he'd fought and won a decision against Connor Hune, who I knew was a good wrestler and a favorite student of Eddie Bravo's, a rubber guard practitioner. I never saw that fight, but I could draw some conclusions. That Connor had either taken Brett down or got taken down at some point and worked the rubber guard with skill and confidence. Connor was pretty good on the ground, so I could safely assume that Brett had some decent submission defense or he'd have been submitted. Maybe I would have told Rory not to burn out looking for submissions. Of course, no one had done his homework and looked up Brett Cooper. Zay talked to Rory for a second and then demonstrated a little thing, a refinement of the squeeze that Rory could have used to finish. Getting someone to submit is a question of convincing him that he has no options other than tapping. A part of getting a submission is mental. Convincing the guy that he's caught, it's over. You make everything tight, squeeze everything down, and it's so horrible that he taps. Rory had the triangle sunk, but had squeezed on only one axis, giving Brett a little room to keep breathing. And Brett had known enough to wait in that space, that he could wait Rory out from there. He didn't panic. Zay showed Rory the other axis he'd had to squeeze on, scissor his thighs together as well as pull everything down and tight. Rory, face bloody and swelling, leaped down on the mat to try it. "Geez, Mario, I wish we'd rolled beforehand," he said with a glimpse of his old humor returning. I went out to lunch with Pat a while later and set out to pick his brain. "Careers go through cycles," he said. Rory had great results from blasting people. He had so much power. But as he moves up a level, he runs into some hard things, learns some lessons, and he's realized he needs to adjust his game. Now, he has to concentrate on his grappling and wrestling, and I'll bet you he gets pretty good on the ground. The example that shines is George St. Pierre. GSP was the UFC title holder at 170 pounds and a spectacular fighter. He's a perfect physical specimen, poised to be a dominant champ, a pound-for-pound great. But GSP never wrestled in high school or college. MMA is rife with spectacular NCAA championship wrestlers, and the conventional wisdom is that if you didn't have it by now, you wouldn't get it. Wrestlers are born and bred in programs in the United States, and they wrestle fanatically in junior high, high school, and college, going to summer camps in Iowa or Oklahoma, a near-religious fervor running through the acolytes. If you didn't get in on the ground floor, if you didn't wrestle year-round starting in about sixth grade, you could never come near those top guys. GSP, though, took to wrestling like a fish to water. He applied himself as an adult, picked it up, and used his newly learned skills to out-wrestle some of the top 170-pound fighters who had absolutely stellar wrestling backgrounds. George out-wrestled Josh Koscheck and Matt Hughes, both former Division I All-Americans. Koscheck had been number one in the nation. John Fitch was captain of his Purdue wrestling team, and GSP was too much for him. This from a guy who never wrestled in high school or college? Conventional wisdom held that this was impossible. Pat continued. Jens Pulver used to out-wrestle people. He'd take them down and outwork them and scrap. But then he used a low back injury as an excuse to just stand and trade with people. He became a crowd pleaser, but to me, that's bullshit. It's about winning fights. Jens is eating punches and kicks, getting knocked out. Then he beats Cub Swanson with a guillotine, and he's back on track. Pat was talking about a creeping insidious problem in fight sports, in MMA in particular. Fighting in the UFC is entertainment. It's asses in seats. That's the bottom line for promoters. People want knockouts, vicious exchanges, and bloody wars, and not necessarily the best fighters in the world. Especially the casual fans. They just want to hear that they're watching the best in the world. So do you fight exciting or fight to win? Win-win-win is from boxing and wrestling, said Pat. But that whole mentality is starting to leave the MMA thing now. Pride, the Japanese promotion, understood that and guaranteed flat fees. So go out and be exciting, you'll get paid anyway. You could lose three and get another three-fight deal. The more I start to think about the problem, the bigger it gets for me. Do you want to see the most exciting fighters on TV or the best? Aren't the best boxers more fun to watch? Would you rather watch Floyd Mayweather, the best, or Arturo Gatti, the more exciting? When Floyd and Arturo finally fought, Floyd demolished Gatti in six rounds without getting hit. Is it pro wrestling, all about the spectacle, or is it fighting? Pat finished his coffee and said, "In this sport, nobody wins a world title undefeated. You have to lose fights to get better, honestly. Rory likes to bang and put on a show. He had the guy hurt. The guy put a takedown on him, survived him, and turned it around. It was a good experience for Rory." Pat thought a minute, then continued. "A loss is sometimes just the thing to bring a guy back to earth. Some guys will be on a roll and turn into complete assholes." He smiled. He'd seen that scenario, having had so many champions, so many ups and downs. Pat is a wrestler at heart. That's where his sympathies lie, and where his philosophies about training are grounded. In my MMA career, I tried to follow Dan Gable step by step. Gable was a workhorse. His ethic and aggressiveness made everyone he wrestled with better. He made everyone around him better through his tenacity. As a coach, he beat the shit out of everyone on his teams well into his 40s. Having great training partners kick the shit out of you makes you better. That's how Gable did it. He kicked the shit out of everyone. The ones that toughed it out got great. Those guys toughened up the new guys, and it creates a team of killers. Pat grew up here in Iowa and wrestled, firmly in the grip of the cult of Gable. Pat ruminates on the MFS slip from the preeminent position in the MMA world. Whereas MFS used to have three UFC title holders and a half dozen contenders, now, there are only contenders. His champions have aged and fallen from the number one spots. Some of it's father time, and some of it is the growth of the sport. The field of competition is exponentially deeper than it was even 5 years ago. But to Pat, the reasons are personal. I think the problem is that I trained as if I was going to die if I didn't win. We've lost some of that desperation in training right now. It's my fault. I can't train like I used to, with my bad neck. And you have to lead by example. Pat has a neck injury from training that needs surgery, but he resists it, fighting the idea that he's getting older. He laughed. I can't scream at guys the way I used to. I used to be screaming all the time. The mind follows the body. So torture the body, and the mind gets used to it. The body learns to accept being miserable, and it's no big deal. When you get to a certain level of conditioning, you feel like you can walk through a wall. As guys get in better shape, they get mentally stronger. And as they get mentally stronger, their bodies get tougher. It's a leapfrog effect. Pat's style has always been hard-nosed. In high school, he'd been an all-state nose guard weighing only 165 pounds, which is tiny for that position. Uniformly, the coaches described him as both the toughest and meanest player they'd ever seen, John Wertheim wrote in Blood in the Cage. Being hard-nosed necessitates outworking an opponent. I fought this big Cherokee Indian, who was a highly ranked cruiserweight boxer at the time, Jason Fickle, and he had a good wrestling background. I planned on taking him down and submitting him, but he kept getting back up. I couldn't hold him down. But I couldn't really change my game plan because he was a good striker who hit hard. So I just kept running my head into the wall. I kept taking him down. I was hard-headed like that. If something wasn't working, I'd keep trying it until it worked. I was well-rounded, but I didn't switch that easy. You gotta think that you're gonna win no matter what. That the other guy will start looking for a way out. You're the predator, not the prey. You don't give a flying fuck what he's doing. You're just setting him up for the finish. He laughed, a short bark. But there's nothing worse than when you think you're setting a guy up for the finish, and the whole time he's ahead of you. That's the cool thing about fighting. That's the final stage, when you can lure a guy in. Like when you start being offensive to counterpunch. You throw the 1-2, and he thinks he's countering, and you counter him. That's the end level, when things get really cool. I asked him how you get there, and he smiled at me. There's only one way there. A lot of ass-whoopings. He chuckled nastily, but he meant it. When you first start fighting, it's tunnel vision. You're freaking out. But as you gain experience, things slow down. The combos start to come at you in slow motion. A big part of it is being relaxed. The studies show when police officers' and soldiers' heart rates hit certain levels, they lose motor skills except push and pull. They fall into tunnel vision. They lose decision-making. It happens to young fighters, certainly, until they take enough beatings to relax. That resonated with something else I'd heard when I spoke briefly to Mike Lorario, the site manager at the Army Center for Enhanced Performance at Fort Bragg in North Carolina. ACEP was doing sports psychology work with special forces guys, but not what you'd think. Not fear management or kill-related, but language learning and self-awareness and recovery. They were actively using biofeedback, something called an M-wave monitor. There's a little sensor that attaches to the ear, Mike said. With infrared, it measures the distances between heartbeats. We're looking at variability. If the heartbeat is regular, then the subject has a high coherent state with brainwave activity, which is conducive to being in the zone. If it's irregular, then it's low coherence. There's little lights, so green means high coherence, blue means moderate, and red means low. But we don't train for color, because sometimes excitement is important. We don't want a guy thinking he has to be green before he breaches a doorway, but afterward, for recovery, for planning, then it's important. Certainly, what Pat was talking about, taking a lot of beatings, being able to be relaxed, coherent, that was key. I sighed with the knowledge that there's no easy way. You gotta take a lot of beatings. Pat smiled at me. We chewed in silence. I give guys game plans in practice, and you sometimes see the light bulb go off in their head. But there's a limit. Game plans matter, but mostly it's about the guy you're fighting. Most people's logic is, okay, this guy sucks on the ground. Let's take him to the ground. But he's so ready for that. Sometimes you say to yourself, okay, he's great at stand-up and weak on the ground. So let's destroy him standing, and he's through. Get the best of him on the feet, and he's crushed. And when you do take him down, he'll give up. So sometimes, go right after a guy to mess with his head. But you gotta be well-rounded to do that. A guy who's a great athlete, who understands the game. You run right into his punches, beat him up, and he thinks, holy shit, I'm in trouble. I think having fighters watch tape can be bad too. It'll give you a false sense of security. If he looks shitty on tape and comes out blasting, you think, wait a minute, this was supposed to be easier. And then you're in trouble. And guys will change a lot in this sport, between fights. I think it's better to focus on what you're gonna do and make him be good enough to stop it. Know his tendencies for sure. And I'll get guys to spar different ways to emulate an opponent or use certain submission setups. But fundamentals will always wear them down. I fought a guy once who had gone down to Brazil and smashed everybody in this Vale Tudo tournament, and I didn't see the tape. So I fought him and beat him. And afterward, I watched the tape, and I was so glad I hadn't seen it, because I would have been petrified. The guy fucked up all the top Brazilians, threw them around like ragdolls. We drank some coffee, and the talk moved on to Rory. Rory's got the physical capabilities to be as good as anybody out there. But will his mind take him there? He's been very one-dimensional. He didn't perceive himself in any other way. He has to change that perception of himself. He has to understand that he can change his identity. He's young enough. Shit, I went up to Montreal years ago, and none of those guys could wrestle. And look at GSP now. When guys lose, it's easy to talk about it because of my own experiences. I went 15-0, and then lost to Matt Hume, who was the best in the world at the time. But I was disgusted. I was going to retire. I was all through. I thought, holy shit, I'm not that good. But after a while, the fire relit and I went on another run. It's simple. You're going to lose if you're fighting badasses. Randy Couture's been down and out twice. I'll talk about Matt Hughes, who quit to farm full-time. I went up and argued with him while he was sitting on his tractor. This is before the Carlos Newton fight, when he won his first belt. It's the guys who go to the breaking point again and again and don't give up. It's up to you. Sure, some guys are in it to be a fighter, or to be part of a team, or get girls and be on TV, but there are guys who honestly know that if they don't give up, they're going to be world champion. The real guys know if they keep at it, they can win a title. I would always mentally convince myself there's no other option. We started talking about backgrounds, about upbringing and experiences. Pat himself had plenty of fuel, an abusive father who died of cancer young, and a lot of tragedy, brothers dying, going to jail, committing suicide. There's some guys out there that are from normal families, that are still animals and smash people. But usually it helps if you've had a shitty life. If somebody's starving, then somebody else is getting his ass kicked. Rory's next fight was in the spring, on the Affliction card in Chicago. The IFL was in the process of folding, its mysterious business plan untenable. Rory was on the verge of being a free agent. There was money to be made. Rory had decided to address his wrestling head-on. He was sparring less and wrestling more, working out with the local high school coach, Brian Glenn, who had been third in the nation at one point and was about the same weight. We talked on occasion, and he took heart from the success of George St. Pierre. Rory would eventually make his way to overtime wrestling and a gym full of Olympians. I came out a few days before the fight. My first thought had been to get a hotel, stay out of the way. But then you realize that's not what's needed. Fighters, in the last days before a fight, shouldn't be alone. They can't train too much, so their energy level gets high, and the oppressive weight of the oncoming fight looms large. Rory even laughed about it. Dude, don't leave me alone in my house watching fight tapes and doing push-ups and freaking out. We went to dinner. We went to the movies. We watched TV. I kept Rory company as he worked out, as he finalized his cut. There was a big gleaming gym near his house that he liked to use, so his girlfriend dropped us off. Even before we started, Rory was bony and pale, and his natural good humor was long gone. He grew quieter and quieter as hunger and dehydration took their toll. And this for a catch weight, informal, of 180 pounds. A full 10 pounds heavier than what he normally had to make. We sat in the sauna and began to tell stories to pass the time. Rory's background is somewhat typical for a fighter. The estranged father, the single working mother, the tough part of town. Rory has his own demons of rage. He loves to fight. He's capable of getting really crazy. He's looked into the void. He started telling me a story I knew a little of, as we sat dripping onto the dry bone boards, the heat itching our skins. A lot of people said they were his best friend, but Ed Bielskis was my best friend. We were inseparable. He lived four houses down from me. He would steal his dad's car to take me to my full contact karate tournaments. We were hoodlums. Rory looked over at me, his eyes almost hidden beneath a tight wool hat. He was in a full sauna suit, made of plastic material like trash bags, and a sweatshirt and sweatpants to keep the sweat sloughing off him. I was sweating like a pig just in a t-shirt and shorts. I was 15. He was 16. We were at the White Hen Pantry, hanging out, corner store, trying to whittle smokes off the cashier. Ed wandered off, and about an hour later, a cop came by asking, "Is Rory Markham here?" Of course we got into a lot of trouble, so I dummied up. But listening to his walkie-talkie, I hear him talking about Ed. So I confessed to being Rory and tried to figure out what was going on, and the cop just got me in the car and drove off. We came around the block, and four stories up, across from the hospital is a parking garage. Ed is standing on one of the pillars, on the northeast corner, up on the pillar. I can see it like a painting. There were cops, ambulances, fire trucks, and I was thinking to myself, what a fucking asshole. And I assured the cop, "Don't worry about a thing." I thought he was fucking around. Rory's voice was confident, everything a big joke. He paused and shook his head. "That's something I've had to live with. I was sure I could get him down." Now, Ed had been doing some crazy things, like buying a boat with his dad's credit card. But his dad was wealthy, and Ed had never even uttered the word suicide in passing. The reasons are mysterious. Rory mentioned that Ed was adopted, and that it was troubling him, but it's impossible for Rory to say. You can see that bothers him, the unfathomable nature of it, the unknown horrors of the human heart. If Rory doesn't know this, about his best friend, then can anyone know anything about anyone? I said to the cop, "Don't worry about it." A counselor was talking to him, but he was shouting for me, "Get Rory up here." I came through the door, and he said everybody else stay back. And when I got 5 feet from him, he held his hand out and started inching back on the ledge. He told me to stay there. I was saying, "What are you doing? I love you." I knew he was serious. His eyes were... He was not there. I knew shit was fucked up. I remember with every inch that I came closer, any movement, a hair would blow, and he would inch his heels out over the ledge. His feet were more than 50% off the ledge. I tried to talk to him, but he just kept shaking his head. He said, "I just wanted you to be here." Then he threw the keys to his brand new Ford Explorer. "And you know how important a car is for a teenager. It's who you are." And then he went. He jumped like a reverse cannonball. He put his head down so his head would hit first. He flipped into a dive. The sauna ticked, quietly. There was an enormous pool of blood. Rory paused and spit on the floor. I had nothing to offer him. I thought about this book and the fighter's mind, the motivations. The heat pressed in around us. Eventually, Rory started talking about the aftershocks, how everyone claimed Ed as a friend, people who barely knew him. I'd make weird promises to myself and Ed, and I promised Ed in the bad times that I would become a professional. I'd fight in the UFC, I promised. Rory looked at me and shrugged, and we went out to the chill air. We went from sauna to the stationary bikes. Rory had a system. He had to keep a sweat going to drop the water weight for the weigh-in. He cut too much, down to 178 at the end of an hour from 185. It came off too easy, but that meant it would go back on easy. He still had plenty of water left in him. At the weigh-in, Rory's opponent, Jay Ellis, finally showed. A muscular, smaller black man with glasses, a little on edge. Jay had a losing record, and he'd lost several fights in a row, but the worst part is that he weighed in shockingly low, 161. Most people didn't catch it, but the few fighters who were friends with Rory laughed, and a murmur ran around the room. Ellis was a replacement for Taewon Howard, who got hurt. A one-week notice guy, and probably the only opponent the promoter could find. He fights at 155 normally. Rory can rehydrate, and did so with relish. He made 180.6. In a way, the fight was its own kind of test for Rory. Could he maintain his professionalism? Could he stay focused without a credible threat? When the fight happened, Jay Ellis, doing his crazy routine, ran at Rory and leaped, basically, completely over him. Rory pounced and started to work, but they were too close to the cage, and Jay used his feet to run up the fence and reverse Rory. Then, lo and behold, Rory slipped on the triangle from the bottom, and Jay was tapping before it was even closed, because Rory was using the squeeze properly, as Zay had shown him. To Jay, it felt tight, and it felt hopeless. Rory's feet weren't even in the proper position. He hadn't secured the hold, but the squeeze was there. Witness to the execution. Unpredictably, the moment of grace breaks upon you, and the question is whether you are ready to receive it. Andrew Cooper. Gunpowder was invented in China, maybe as far back as 850, and it traveled to Japan in the form of fireworks. It was never actually weaponized, and when the Portuguese introduced firearms in 1500, the Japanese reacted strongly. The ruling caste saw the social hazards and an end to their way of life in the potential equalizer, and so banned it. They continued their endless feudal autumn, wherein most lives had little value, and samurai dueled to the death with the weapons of their grandfathers and great-great-grandfathers, the long and short swords. While the rest of the world plunged into the abyssal arms race, the samurai caste refined their techniques, using the tools they had perfected. These swords were the sharpest-edged weapons ever created by man. Smiths, considered national treasures and guarding their secrets, poured their souls into the blades, folding and pounding the steel thousands of times over months, years. Horrifically deadly, dueling with those weapons was about as far out on the edge as you could go, walking a hair-thin line between life and death, risking everything to take everything. The modern mind reels at the thought of facing off with 3-foot-long razors, where one of us will die. The levels of concentration, stress, and refinement of technique were stratospheric. Miyamoto Musashi, perhaps the greatest swordsman in this era of great swordsmen, wrote a book of fighting and strategy called Gorin no Sho, The Book of Five Rings. Musashi was a warrior who rose to prominence by winning all his duels, some 60 of them. He was the culmination of a caste and way of life that devoted the entirety of its energies to study of the sword. He achieved a level of mastery that may never be seen again. When I started writing this book, I was thinking about it as an updated Book of Five Rings, which has become a kind of knee-jerk part of any traditional martial arts philosophy. It was even adopted in the 1980s, when the Japanese business model was booming, as a self-help book for businessmen. A lot of people have found inspiration and guidance in the book, for all sorts of reasons. But one must never lose sight of what Gorin no Sho is finally about. Cutting. Andre Ward was the only American boxer to win gold in the 2004 Olympics. I have known Andre and his trainer and godfather, Virgil Hunter, since 2003. I wrote extensively about them in my first book, curious about the development of a red-hot boxing prospect in the early stages of a professional career. I had spent several months at King's Boxing Gym, a throwback gym, dank, gritty, and functional. I lived near them in Oakland, in the desert heat, and drove through the dusty streets and sprinted hills and ran the parks. Virgil said to me once, "I knew Andre would win gold at the Olympics because I was influenced in my training by the Book of Five Rings, and that's the symbol for the Olympics, five rings." Virgil and I have an interesting friendship. He's in his 50s, black, from a militant background, Oakland and Berkeley in the 60s, and the overtones of black power. He'd come up from the streets, and I was a white kid from the East Coast who went to Harvard. We were using each other in a classic boxing way, mercenary but mutually beneficial. I was getting good material for my book, and Virgil was getting exposure for himself and his fighters. He knew how I saw him, as a wise trainer, and he could play that role, but he also knew it was no bullshit. Virgil really did have a profound understanding of the game. He had the goods, and he knew it. Boxing is about reputations, and Virgil knew that the more I wrote about him, the better for him, but only so long as his fighters were winning. Fighting has that beautiful bottom line. Win. I don't care how wonderful a human being Muhammad Ali was, without his big wins, if he had lost those marquee title fights, he wouldn't be the sportsman of the century. No one would care if he refused the draft or not. No one would care if he changed his name. So I won't overestimate my importance, but I could be a help. Plus, we had a genuine liking for each other, a respect because I could understand him. To a certain extent, I could pick up what he was putting down. Virgil met Andre when he was 9 years old and saw something in the little boy. The ghost of a killer's punch. Some premonition of speed. Andre, his dad, and Virgil had embarked on a career together. Andre's father had been a boxer who loved the sport, and he wanted Andre to learn it properly. How to hit and not be hit. Andre, or Dre to his friends, trekked to the boxing gym after school, and he stuck with it, day in and day out. He was caught in the inevitability of it, like a soldier swept to war. But he was also called by something inside of him. He came to love and hate the gym. The gym is the anvil on which boxers are forged, tempered like a samurai sword with thousands of hammer blows, bending steel into steel. Fighters are born in the dedication to repetition. It's not about who is stronger and faster, although those things can cover for other problems. Nothing can replace natural self-discipline. Nothing can replace time in the gym. Andre loved boxing, and you have to love it to be great. To compete at the highest level requires 8 or 10 years of groundwork, going to the gym and working to get better every day, day in and day out, with no end in sight. You have to love the journey. Malcolm Gladwell's book Outliers is a fascinating look at success. He talks at length about the search for innate talent, and a mind-blowing study he cites is an investigation by psychologists at the elite Berlin Academy of Music. These psychologists looked at the violinists and found a very simple correlation. The more they practiced, the better they were. They checked it with the pianists and found the same thing. Everybody had some talent and started playing around age 5. But when the students were around the age of 8, real differences started to emerge. The students who would end up the best in their class began to practice more than everyone else. Until, by the age of 20, they were practicing over 30 hours a week. These were the players who were the virtuosos, the ones who would go on to become famous performers, world-class talents, geniuses. The lower half, who did only 8 hours a week, were destined to be music teachers. And the incredible thing was there were no naturals who were at the top without this commitment. Nobody in the top third didn't practice 30 hours a week since childhood, and there weren't any grinds. Guys who worked that hard, but just couldn't make it. There's a magical number. 10,000 hours of diligent, intentional, informed practice. That's it. And what's more, the people at the very top don't just work harder, or even much harder than everyone else. They work much, much harder. The 10,000 hours thing apparently comes up in just about every field and discipline. I had a painting teacher who told me in college, "You just got to push paint around for 10 years before you figure it out." Even a prodigy like Mozart got in 10,000 hours. He just started early. Gladwell wasn't the first to notice this. The basic signifier for expertise had been set at 10 years of practice by everyone studying these things, but his book is well written and really brought the point home. With boxers, with fighters, you have to get your 10,000 hours in before you're too old to fight. Which is why you have to start so young. and there's a certain amount of athletic ability and toughness needed. Gladwell makes the point in basketball. If you're 5'5", you can practice 10,000 hours with the best coaches in the country and still probably not play in the NBA. But if you're over 6'5", if you have the bare minimum of ability, then it comes down, overwhelmingly, to commitment. Virgil started sparring Andre at around age 11, with a kid named Glenn Donaire, who's won flyweight, 112-pound titles, as has his brother Nonito, the current IBF flyweight champ. Glenn was older, and about the same size, but more advanced and physically mature. He would put it on Dre with ease. I wouldn't let Dre take a real beating, but I'd let him get frustrated. He'd get hit. At this point, Glenn so far outclassed Dre that Glenn wasn't concerned at all with what Dre would throw back. Virgil talked at the local coffee shop, coffee with a beat, sipping his tea, his eyes hidden behind his glasses. Watchful, his voice was quiet with the sibilance of confidence. Dre was running all around the ring, ducking and dodging, turning, grabbing, holding on. Not punching, but surviving. So I encouraged that. "Don't let him hit you," I told Dre. I never mentioned fighting back. I wanted to know if he could take it before he started dishing it, to handle the pressure. He can't beat you up if he can't catch you. Virgil, as a trainer, needs to always evaluate where his fighter is mentally. Especially at a young age, you need to see what you've got. Because otherwise, Virgil could waste years of his life training someone who will never be successful. Virgil smiles. Sometimes there were tears, but they were retaliatory tears. He laughed. I would cheerlead Dre. Man, he missed you by a foot. And watch Glenn. Glenn was so confident, he would finally walk Dre down, when Dre got tired, and stand right in front of him and look him over. Glenn would stand there and look for an opening to land his punches. This went on for weeks, with Dre learning how to move, to get out of the way, to avoid damage from a better, stronger, more experienced guy. So I taught Dre this little hook-jab-type punch, and I told him every time he stops in front of you, hit him with this little punch, and then go move again. Lo and behold, the next sparring session, Glenn pulls up in front of Dre, and pow, Dre pops him, and then he goes. Of course, this incited Glenn. We've been sparring 3 weeks and you've never hit me. So he would swarm Dre and try to get the last hard punch in. The next couple of weeks, that was the routine. Hit him and move fast. Just as Glenn was pouring it on, I'd stop it. I'd let Dre take one good hard shot, and then I'd stop it. Middle of the round or whatever. I was looking for one thing. I can imagine Dre's life. The constancy of the boxing gym after school, the routines and smells of leather and Vaseline, hand wraps and boxing shoes. Ever present was his white father, Frank Ward, who'd been a heavyweight with 10 amateur fights, who pushed him and believed in him, and tall Virgil watching and teaching him. Virgil had been an officer at a juvenile delinquent hall his whole working life. One thing he understood was young men's psyches. This went on for a while. And then one day, after Glenn hit Dre with a good shot, I said, "That's it, that's enough." And Dre said, "No, no, I'm all right." And that's what I was looking for, that statement. Now I began to really teach Dre how to hit him with punches. I told Dre, "You can hit him with anything you want. Number one, he won't believe you can do it. And number two, by the time he does believe it, you'll be whooping him." Now Dre already knew. What I've been through, it can't get any worse. That's all he can do to me. And he knew how to get away from Glenn. He started working jabs and hooks, and within 3 weeks, he was dominating Glenn, and they stopped boxing us. That's what happens when you fight on your terms. Virgil taught Dre what he called the slip and slide, a Texas style of boxing that could trace its roots as far back as Jack Johnson, the first black heavyweight champ in 1908. It's not necessarily a crowd-pleasing style. When it emerged, it wasn't respected. It has a lot of hidden components. Dre's Olympic run in 2004, when the details are told, takes on a rocky feel. Dre's father died suddenly, of heart failure, in 2002, out of the blue. One morning, he was gone. Dre, at the age of 18, stood over the grave and promised to bring back Olympic gold. He struggled for a reason to continue, and his growing family and sense of faith helped rebuild the steel. There were shadowy dreadnoughts in the mists of international amateur boxing. It was an uphill climb from the start, as Dre was dramatically undersized for his division. Virgil had made the decision, in January of the year before, to fight Dre at 178 pounds, because he thought he was still in a growth spurt. But that growth tapered off. Dre fought his way through the Olympics weighing 170 in that 178-pound weight class. Virgil would make him drink a Gatorade right before the weigh-in so he wouldn't be too light, when most guys were probably cutting 4 or 5 pounds to make 178. And not only that, they were men. In the European system, boxers will often spend 8 years as an amateur, fighting in major competitions and culminating in the Olympics. While in the United States, a good boxer, without the financial support, will go pro much quicker. Dre was up against, essentially, professional men who were much bigger and vastly more experienced. The Rocky IV villain in this story was Yevgeny Makarenko, a 6'5" Russian fighter who'd won the world amateur championships for several years, with apparent ease. He'd beaten everyone he might face in the Olympics, including the perennial runner-up, Magomed Erbgachev from Belarus. Makarenko was the heavy favorite to win gold, but he had never fought Dre. Both Dre and Virgil maintain this was not by chance, but by design. And not only was it God's will, but also strategy. Virgil recalls during the run-up to the Olympics that every boxing coach he talked to told him that Dre had to go to middleweight, where maybe he could medal. Virgil says he intentionally kept Andre out of the Pan Am Games and the Worlds, where he would have faced international competition at a top level. I was branded a fool. Even my wife told me I was messing with Andre's career. Virgil had a plan. I believe that if they've never seen him, if they can't game plan for him, they can't beat him in 4 2-minute rounds. There's just too much going on. Speed kills, and in amateur boxing, which focuses on point scoring, Dre's speed gave him an insidious advantage. The weight differences, which might have told over a longer, more punishing professional fight, weren't as crushing in the shorter amateur fights. Dre remembers entering the arena, the enormity of the event all around him. The United States had just invaded Iraq and was seen as a power-hungry aggressor. And here, on the world stage, the boos were raucous, the disapproval given vent. The athletes had been prepped. They knew the boos were coming, and I didn't take it personal, Dre said. But it was an eye-opener, that this is a big world stage. Any time the U.S. fans tried to get rowdy, they'd be booed down by the crowd, instantly. It was almost laughable. Dre stood under the wash of boos and shook it off like water off a duck. When he entered the ring, he couldn't hear them. His focus was so complete. He went out and did his thing and blitzkrieged the first fighter he faced, winning through to the next bracket. He would face Makarenko in the quarterfinals. The next day, Dre had to ride the same bus as Makarenko to the fight, and he can remember Makarenko smirking at him, laughing at him with a friend. Dre was dismissed as too small, too inexperienced for this world stage. For Dre, it was David and Goliath. I would see those guys smirking at me, and I was reminded of when Goliath laughed at David and asked him, "Who were you to come and fight me? Am I a dog?" And that fired David up. Dre fought the fight of his life. He used his speed, bounding in and out from the much taller, longer fighter. Dre put it on him. Of the fight, Virgil muses that Makarenko could win, but not in that time. He wasn't prepared to. Dre dominated the Russian, 23-16. That disrupted the whole thinking of all the trainers, Virgil recalls with a smile. Here you got Makarenko, who hasn't lost in 5 years. He's beaten every fighter in the division, and so is the fighter from Belarus. But Makarenko always beat him by 8 or 9 points. What did this do to Magomed, the Belarus fighter? Virgil chuckles. That was the best feeling, knowing what we'd done to the division. He remembers going back to the house he was staying at in Greece, on the beach, and listening to the waves crash and smelling the jasmine and lavender through his window and feeling exhilarated. It was a great moment for me as a coach. We forced the entire division, all this world-class talent, to rethink its strategy. But Dre was exhausted, emotionally. He'd burned out his adrenaline. He used up his tank to beat Makarenko. Dre drew on his faith. He took strength from it when he couldn't imagine he had any left, and went out and won the semifinal in a hard fight against a tough guy from Uzbekistan. For that fight, I knew it would be ugly, because Dre was so emotionally spent. So I said to him, "Just go fight the guy and win. He has to stop you from doing what you do. Just win and it will recharge you." Then the final, the gold medal match, against the Belarusian, against a fighter who had served as a gatekeeper to the best fighter in the division. Dre talks about the necessity of changing plans in a fight. What I had done to Makarenko wasn't working as well, the getting in and out. He was timing me. I'd go back to the corner between rounds and be a point down or a point up. In the third, I made an adjustment and started to really put pressure on him, using my speed up close, and he went downhill. He got winded. He was in his comfort zone out there picking me off, and I pushed him out of it. The international crowd had stopped booing Andre and cheered him. The Rocky cycle was complete. Dre's faith continues to be his bedrock, his source of strength. "It's everything," he says. "And it's not just faith in faith. I have faith in Jesus Christ. This game, boxing, is so brutal, mentally, physically, financially, that me and Verge always joke we wouldn't dare be in this game without God. But it's the truth." When Dre has a fight, he goes into camp, moving in with Virgil. He has a lovely wife and two children he misses badly, but camp has to be all about training. It is a purely selfish place. The fighter has to be focused on himself. This is the worst part of boxing for Dre. "Being away from my family, my heart aches every day. But I use it for motivation. When I run sprints on these hills, if I slow down, I think of them. This is how I make my living, and that, coupled with faith, helps me out. I know God has called me to do this. I know God has called me here for a reason. It's a platform to where I can put God's voice on a worldwide stage." I interviewed Dre after we both worked out, and he stretched, and I sat there with my tape recorder growing cold. He still has some of that boy in him, even as he relaxes into a man. He's only 24, but he's been through a lot. His face has that strange combination of youth and wisdom. There's some of that eternal kid of the professional athlete, who's so specialized that he may not function well in other arenas. But on the other hand, he's an experienced father, and Dre's been in the deepest waters an amateur fighter can be in. "If God has brought you to it, he'll see you through it." He smiles at the stock phrase, but to him, it's not stock. "Although God has given me the power to do what I do, I have to get out there and do it. It doesn't just fall out of the sky. You have to make your destiny happen." After I won the gold medal, I saw God had given me the power to do this. God is real. It's not faith in faith. When I have bad days, when I'm tired and worn down, I can take strength from God, and I can come in here and have the best day I had all week. I need God's strength, his divine enablement, his unmerited favor. That's what grace is. I am reminded of some of the thoughts I'd first had about Dre, about his faith. It's a way forward for him without ego. If you are so much faster than everybody else, if you can see that power as being for a reason, not for your own glory, but for something larger than yourself, it must be a great relief, a powerful tool. Hanging around over the next few days, I was reminded how quiet and watchful Virgil is as a trainer. He's watching his fighters without talking to them much, listening to them, analyzing them. Later, at night, we would just talk. He would talk about what he was seeing, what he was looking for. He had no concerns about Dre, but there was still Antonio Johnson back in camp, and Heather Hartman, and Kareem Maceo, Virgil's adopted son, Simone Carney Hunter, was a devastating puncher as an amateur. And Virg also had a promising heavyweight named Marlo Dion. I always thought that Virgil would be a good trainer for a heavyweight, being tall, but also because Virgil wouldn't accept that a heavyweight has to be slow and just powerful. Why can't a heavyweight have the quick feet of a middleweight? Virgil talked about the necessity of consistency in training. You got to be screwed up in a lot of respects to fight anyway. I mean to take it to the pinnacle. To find those reasons day in and day out. The ability to know that somewhere out there, all those days ahead, his voice slowed and drawled for emphasis. Hundreds of days, thousands of days. That one day is yours, somewhere. You work hard for it, for that one day. Then everything changes, and you have to be ready for it. Fighters live in preparation for instantaneous flashes, that one brief span of time that will define them for the rest of their lives. That moment when everything they've done, everything they will do, and everything they are is evaluated. There's really nothing like it. Nothing with the same level of preparation and risk. You can sense the change coming. Like with Andre, for him, the day is at hand. Virgil means that this is Andre's breakout year. This is the year they come into the limelight. He means fighting and winning titles. That day you transform from getting to keeping. You have to be prepared for it. Virgil talked about the recent Ricky Hatton-Floyd Mayweather fight. He looked at me and said quietly, "I was paying close attention to Ricky Hatton. He had accepted losing, by decision, as a possibility. He knew that was a very real chance. He wanted to lose on his terms, so he fought the way he did. Because Ricky knew he wouldn't lose anything by losing a decision. But getting knocked out, that wasn't on his script." And Virgil shows me a flash of that small, ruthless smile. "Ricky didn't think that could happen, so that's why it did. You always have to be aware that you could lose. I could get knocked out or tapped out. Anything is possible in the ring. Don't stop short of anything. You train 99% of eventualities in training camp, but missing that 1% could get you knocked out. Your whole camp is serious disillusion." Virgil leaned toward me so I could follow. "If you and I were over in Iraq right now, we're thinking about bullets flying. We're not thinking, hey, I might get wounded, you see? You can get killed, and you react as such." Virgil continued, leaning back. "That's the one thing that intrigued me about the Book of Five Rings. There was no trophy. It was understood there was a winner and a dead man, which makes my approach to training totally different if I'm going to die. It's impossible for you to train the same way. I don't care how much you practice. I don't care how sharp your sword is or what famous smith made it. If you go into a sword fight for points, you'll never obtain what I'm obtaining with the dull sword against somebody that's gonna die." I thought about that, about how my own training had always been compromised by a lack of sincerity, a lack of life or death intensity. I had been wasting Virgil's time when I trained with him, and he had seen it and treated me accordingly. He'd done the best he could with me, without overly investing his time, because it was obvious that I wasn't going to win titles. Virgil continued on his riff. "When I think about Hatton, that's what I think about. He didn't have respect for his opponent. He never thought about Floyd knocking out 30 other guys, and Floyd knew this. He had it all together in his mind. This isn't the best fighter, the best boxer. This is a person who has it all in perspective, and he reacts accordingly. Successful professional fighters are the ones who achieve perspective at an early age." Virgil smiled. "If I tell you my intent is to kill you in the ring, I'll get labeled all sorts of things. But that's my intent, within the rules. This is a serious business, and you have to recognize the underlying truth that fighting is a hurt business, as Mike Tyson, the poet laureate of rage, once said." Virgil and I kept talking, and he moved on to Andre in his last fight in St. Lucia, where the promoter, surprised, said, "I never realized that this kid was mean." "He was looking for something conventional," Virgil said. "Was Mike Tyson really a killer because he went out and got you in two rounds? Or did he just punch well, and he was scared? We found out later on in Mike's career. He fired his weapons out of fear. When you fire out of fear, there's a demolition effect. It's crude, panicky. When you fire out of calculation, it has a slower effect. That's what I'm getting at with Andre. They haven't woken up to the fact that